Chapter 11. I have a giant case dropped in my lap on Thursday. One of our biggest clients, let's just say they revolutionized the health food store, wants to announce an acquisition of a delivery service company on Monday before the markets open. David and I were supposed to go home to Philadelphia and tell my parents the December plan in person, but it's never going to happen this weekend. I call him at 8. While crouched over piles of documents in the conference room. There are 12 other associates and 4 partners barking orders, and containers of empty Chinese food surrounding me. It's a war zone. I love it. I'm not getting out of here this weekend, I tell him. Even to come home to sleep, forget Philly. I hear the TV on behind him. What happened? Can't say, but it's a big one. No shit, he says. I clear my throat. I'm going to be sleeping here for the next 3 days. Can we do next weekend? I have Pat's bachelor party. Right, Arizona. They're going to drink beer and practice target shooting, neither of which David has any interest in. I'm not even sure why he's going. He barely sees Pat anymore. It's fine, he says. We'll just call and fill them in. They'll be thrilled either way. I think your mom was starting to give up on me. My parents love David, of course they do. He's a lot like my brother, or what I imagine he'd have turned out to be. Smart, calm, even-tempered. Michael never got in trouble. He was the one making chore charts when we were kids, and he did Model UN before he even learned to drive. He and David would be friends, I know they would. And it still stings me that he's not here, that he won't ever be here. That he didn't see me graduate or accept my first job, hasn't been to our apartment, and won't get to watch me get married. My parents bugged David and me incessantly during the first 2 years of our engagement to set a date, but less so now. I know how much they want this for me and themselves. David's wrong. At this point, they'd probably be fine with City Hall. Okay, my dad might be in the city next week. Thursday. David says. I'm already taking him to lunch. Oh, you're the best. He makes a non-committal noise through the phone. Just then, Aldridge walks into the room. I hang up on David without saying goodbye. He'll understand. He used to do the same thing to me all the time at Tishman. How's it looking? Aldridge asks. Normally, a managing partner would not ask a senior associate how an acquisition of this magnitude was looking. He'd go directly to a senior partner in the room. But since Aldridge hired me, we've developed a real rapport. From time to time, he calls me into his office to talk about cases or offer me guidance. I know the other associates notice, and I know they don't like it. And it feels great. There are a few ways to get ahead at a corporate law firm, and being the managing partner's favorite is definitely one of them. Most corporate lawyers are sharks. But I've never heard Aldridge so much as raise his voice. And he somehow manages to have a personal life. He's been married to his husband, Josh, for 12 years. They have a daughter, Sonia, who is 8. His office is peppered with photos of her, them. Vacations, school pictures, Christmas cards. A real life outside those four walls. We're still in due diligence, but should have some documents up for signature on Sunday, I say. Saturday. Aldridge hits back. He looks at me, an eyebrow raised. That's what I meant. Did everyone order food? Aldridge announces to the room. In addition to the Chinese food cartons on the conference table, there are burger wrappers from the Palm and chopped salad containers from Quality Italian. But in the middle of a big deal like this, food is a constant necessity. Immediately, all 15 lawyers look up, eyes blinking. Sherry, the senior partner managing the case, answers for the room. We're fine, Miles, she says. Mitch, Aldridge calls for his assistant, who is never more than 10 feet away. Let's order some Levan. Get these fine people a little caffeine and sugar. We've got it covered, really, Sherry starts. These people look hungry, he says. He strolls out of the conference room. I catch Sherry's eyes narrowing before she dives back into the document that's in front of her. Sometimes kindness under pressure can feel like a slight, and I don't blame Sherry for reacting that way. She doesn't have time to console us with cookies. That's a privilege for the very high up. The thing many people don't realize about corporate lawyers is that they are nothing like what you see on TV shows. Sherry, Aldridge, and I will never step foot in a courtroom. We'll never argue a case. We do deals. We're not litigators. We prepare documents and review every piece of paperwork for a merger or an acquisition, or to take a company public. On Suits, Harvey does both paperwork and crushes it in court. In reality, the lawyers at our firm who argue cases don't have a clue what we do in these conference rooms. Most of them haven't prepared a document in a decade. People think our form of corporate law is the less ambitious of the two. And while in many ways it's less glamorous, no closing arguments, no media interviews, nothing compares to the power of the paper. At the end of the day, law comes down to what is written, and we do the writing. I love the order of deal-making, the clarity of language, how there is little room for interpretation and none for error. I love the black-and-white terms. I love that in the final stages of closing a deal, particularly those of the magnitude Wachtell takes on, seemingly insurmountable obstacles arise. Apocalyptic scenarios, disagreements, and details that threaten to topple it all. It seems impossible we'll ever get both parties on the same page, but somehow we do. Somehow contracts get agreed upon and signed. Somehow deals get done. And when it finally happens, it's exhilarating. Better than any day in court. It's written, binding. Anyone can bend a judge's or jury's will with bravado, but to do it on paper, in black and white, that takes a particular kind of artistry. It's truth in poetry. I come home once on Saturday just to shower and change, and on Sunday I drag myself home well past midnight. When I get there, David is asleep, but there's a note on the counter and takeout pasta in the fridge. Cacio Pepe from L'Artusi, my favorite. David is always really thoughtful like this. Having my favorite takeout in the fridge, leaving the chocolate I like on the counter. He spent the weekend at the office as well, but since he moved to the fund, he has more autonomy over his time than I do. I'm still at the mercy of the partners, the clients, and the whims of the market. For David, it's mostly just the market. And since much of the money his company handles is longer-term investment, it takes a lot of the harried day-to-day pressure off. As David likes to say, no one ever runs into my office. I have 2 missed calls and 3 texts from Bella, whom I've ignored all weekend, and in fact, all of last week. She doesn't know David and I got re-engaged on the living room floor, and that we are officially planning a wedding for December. Or we will be anyway when we have a second free. I text her back. Just getting in from an all-weekender. Call you tomorrow. Despite the fact that I haven't slept in close to 72 hours, I don't feel tired. We got the signatures. Tomorrow, or today actually, our clients will announce that they have acquired a $1 billion company. They're expanding their global reach and will revolutionize the way people shop for groceries. I feel like I always do after we close a big case. Hi. I haven't done cocaine except for 1 ill-advised night in college, but it's the same sensation. My heart races, my pupils dilate. I feel like I could run a marathon. We won. There's an open bottle of Chianti on the counter, and I pour myself a glass. Our apartment has a big kitchen window that looks out over Gramercy Park. I sit down at the kitchen table and gaze out the window. It's dark out, but the city lights illuminate the trees and the sidewalk. When I first moved to New York, I used to walk by the park and think that someday I'd live near it. Now, David and I have a key. We can go inside the park anytime we want. But we don't, of course. We're busy. We went the day we got the key, with a bottle of champagne, stayed long enough to open it and make a toast, but haven't been back since. It's pretty to look at through the window, though. And the location is convenient, very central. I promise myself that David and I will take some iced coffees in there and do some wedding planning soon. It's a beautiful apartment. It has 2 bedrooms and high ceilings, a full kitchen and dining area, a TV and couch alcove. We decorated it in all grays and whites. It's calming, serene. It looks like the kind of apartment that gets photographed. It's everything I ever wanted. I look down at my hand, still wearing that engagement ring, and now, soon, a band. I finish my wine, brush my teeth, wash my face, and crawl into bed. I take the ring off and set it in the little bowl on my nightstand. It sparkles back at me, a promise. I vow that first thing tomorrow, I'll call a wedding planner. Chapter 12. I leave work at 7 on Monday, a full hour before I should, and meet Bella at Snack Taverna in the West Village. It's this tiny bistro, the best Greek food in the city, and we've been going there since we moved to New York, way before I could afford to. Bella is back to being 15 minutes late. I order us fava beans drenched in olive oil and garlic, her favorite. They're on the table when she arrives. She texted me back this morning and demanded we have dinner tonight. It has been too long, she said. I feel like you're avoiding me. I rarely leave work early, if ever. When David and I make dinner reservations, they're always for 8:30 or 9. But now it's a little past 7, still light out, and I'm sitting here. Bella has always been the only person in my life who can talk me out of my norm. It's so hot out there, she says when she arrives. She's wearing a white brocade and lace dress from Zimmerman and gold lace-up sandals. Her hair is up in a top knot, some loose strands dangling down her neck. It's a swamp. Summer always happens so suddenly. I lean over the table and kiss her on the cheek. I've sweated through my silk shirt and pencil skirt. I own basically no summer clothes. Luckily, the air conditioning is on full blast in here. How was the weekend? She asks. Did you sleep at all? I smile. No. She shakes her head. You loved it. Maybe. I scoop some beans onto her plate. I have to know. Did you guys hear anything more about the apartment? She looks at me and frowns, and then her face dawns recognition. Oh, right. There's this other one I think I want. It's this totally savage place in Meatpacking. I honestly didn't know they had anything like that left there. Everything is so generic now. You don't like the Dumbo Loft? She shrugs. I'm just not sure I want to live there. There's only one grocery store, and it must be freezing in the winter. All of those wide streets that close to the water, it seems kind of isolated. It's close to every train, I say. And the view is spectacular. There's so much light, Bella. I can see you painting there. Bella squints at me. What's going on? You hated that place. You told me I shouldn't even consider it. I wave her off. She's right, though. What am I doing? The words keep tumbling out like I have no control over them. I don't know, I say. What do I know? I've lived within 10 blocks for the last decade. Bella leans forward. Her face splits into a sly smile. You love that place. It's raw space, but I have to admit, it's beautiful. Somehow industrial and energetic and peaceful all at once. No, I say, firm, definitive. It's a pile of plywood. I'm just playing devil's advocate. Bella crosses her arms. You love it, she says. I don't know why I can't just condemn it. Tell her she's right. It's freezing and too far and absurd, then drop it. I should be thrilled that she has forgotten about it. I want her to forget about it. I want that apartment to disappear into the atmosphere. So far, I'm doing a good job at preventing that fateful hour. If the apartment disappears, so does what happened there. No, it's true, I say. Dumbo is far, and Aaron said it would need a ton of work. The last part is a little bit of a lie. Bella opens her mouth to say something, but closes it again. So things are good with you guys? I venture. Bella sighs. He said you had a nice time at the apartment. Like, maybe you liked him a little better? He said you seemed friendly, which is entirely out of character. Hey, you're many things, Bella says, but friendly never really comes to mind. I have a flash of Bella and me, newly minted New Yorkers in line for some ludicrously expensive club in the Meatpacking District. Bella had lent me one of her dresses, something short and bright, and it was cold, although I don't remember the season, late fall, early winter. We were without coats, as we usually were in the years surrounding 20. In this slice of memory, Bella is flirting with the door guy, a club promoter named Scoot or Hines. Some sound, not word. Someone who liked when hot girls showed up, like when Bella did. She's telling him she just has a few more friends she wants to bring in. "They like you?" he asks.
"No one is," Bella says. She shakes her hair off her neck.
"Her?" Scoot points to me. He's less than impressed. This I can tell. Being Bella's friend has always felt a little bit like standing in her shadow. It used to make me insecure. Maybe it still does, but over time we found our things, our shared ground, our complementing balance. Standing in front of that club, maybe we hadn't yet. Bella leans forward and whispers something into Scoot's ear. I don't hear, but I can imagine what it is.
"She's a princess, you know. She's royalty. Fifth in line to the Dutch throne. A Vanderbilt."
It used to embarrass me that Bella had to do this. It embarrasses me that night in meatpacking, too. But I never tell her. Her proximity is my gift. My silence is hers. I make her life smooth and solid. She makes mine bright and dazzling. This seems fair. A good trade.
"Come on in, ladies," Scoot says.
We do. We enter Twitch, or Slice, or Marked. Whatever it was called, it's gone now. We dance. Men buy us drinks. I feel pretty in her dress, although it is a little too short on me. A little loose in the chest. It hugs in the wrong spots. At a certain point, two men come up to hit on us. I am not interested. I have a boyfriend. He is in law school at Yale. We've been together for 8 months. I'm faithful to him. I think maybe I'll marry him, but it is a passing thought. Everywhere we go, Bella flirts. She does not like that I don't. She thinks I am withholding, that I do not know how to have a good time. She's right, but only sometimes. This form of fun does not come naturally to me, and therefore feels impossible to engage in. I am constantly trying to learn the rules, only to realize that the people who win don't seem to follow any. One of the men makes a comment. Everyone laughs. I roll my eyes. "You're so friendly," he says. It sticks. At the restaurant now, I scoop a fava bean onto a small piece of crisp bread. It's hot, and the garlic pops in my mouth.
"Morgan and Ariel met Greg on Saturday," Bella says. "They loved him."
Morgan and Ariel are a couple Bella met through the gallery scene 4-ish years ago. Since then, they've become more David's and my friends than Bella's, mostly because we're better at making dinner reservations and staying in the country. Morgan is a photographer who does popular cityscapes and had a coffee table book called On High come out last year to much fanfare. Ariel works in private equity.
"Oh? Yeah," Bella says. "I honestly thought you would too," she continues while I chew. "I'm not mad, it's just... you're always wanting me to be more serious and be with someone who cares. Like, you never stop talking about that. And he does. And it doesn't seem to matter to you."
"It matters," I tell her.
I do not want to keep talking about this. "You have a weird way of showing it."
She's annoyed, her voice edgy, her arms outstretched. I sit back. "I know," I say. I swallow. "I mean, I can see that he cares. And I'm happy for you."
"You are?" she says.
"I am," I say. "He seems like a good guy."
"A good guy? Come on, Danny, that's pathetic."
She's petulant, angry. I don't really blame her. I'm giving her nothing.
"I'm really crazy about him," she says. "I've never felt this way before, and I know I've said this a lot, and I know you don't believe me."
"I believe you," I say. Bella sticks her elbows on the table and leans forward, all the way.
"What is it?" she says. "It's me, Danny. You can say anything. You know that. What do you not like about him?"
All at once, my eyes sting up with tears. It is an unusual reaction for me, and I blink, more in surprise than in an effort to stop it. Bella looks so hopeful sitting across from me, naive even. So full of the possibilities she purports to feel. And I have a giant secret I cannot tell her.
Something profound, terrible, and strange has happened in my life, and she doesn't get to know.
I guess I've had you all to myself for a really long time, I say. It's not fair, but the idea of you being with someone for real makes me feel, I don't know, I swallow. Jealous, maybe?
She sits back, satisfied. Thank God I came up with something. Bless me for being a lawyer.
She buys it. This makes sense to her. She knows I have always wanted the space closest to her, front position, and she has given it to me.
But you have David, and it's fine, she says.
Yeah, it's just always been that way, so it feels different.
She nods. But you're right, I say. It's dumb. I guess emotions aren't always rational.
Bella laughs.
I genuinely never thought I'd hear you say those words.
She reaches across the table and squeezes my hand.
Nothing is going to change, I promise you. Or if it does, it'll be for the better. You'll see me even more. You'll see me so much you'll be sick of me.
Well then, cheers. I look forward to being sick of you.
Bella smiles. We clink glasses. Then she waves a hand back and forth in front of her face.
So you like him, sorta. Maybe.
You're jealous.
We'll leave it there, okay?
I shake my head. Sure.
But he really is...
She starts and her voice trails off. Her gaze with it.
I don't know how to describe it. It's like I finally get it, you know? What everyone always talks about.
Bella, I say. That's wonderful.
Bella wiggles her nose.
What's new with you?
I take a deep breath. I blow some air out through my lips.
David and I got engaged, I say.
She picks up her water glass.
Danny, that's decades old news.
4.5 years.
Right.
No, I mean, we're going to get married this time. For real. In December.
Bella's eyes widen. Then they flit down to my hand and back up again.
Holy shit, for real?
For real. It's time. We're both just so busy and there's always a reason not to, but I realize there's a really big reason to do it.
So we will. The waiter comes over and Bella turns to him abruptly.
A bottle of champagne in 10 minutes, she says.
He leaves.
He's been asking me to set a date for a long time.
I'm aware, Bella says, but you always say no.
It's not that I say no, I say. It's just that I haven't said yes.
What changed?
I look at her. Bella, my Bella. She looks so radiant, so high on love. How can I tell her that it's her, that she's the reason?
I guess I just finally know the future I want, I say.
She nods.
Did you tell Meryl and Alan?
My parents. We called them. They're thrilled. They asked if we wanted to do it at the Rittenhouse.
Do you? In Philly? Oh, it's so generic.
Bella wiggles her nose.
I always saw you doing something very Manhattan.
I'm generic, though. You always forget that.
She smiles. But no Philly, I say. It's just inconvenient. We'll see what's available in the city.
The champagne comes, and our glasses are filled.
Bella holds hers to mine.
To good men, she says. May we know them, may we love them, may we love each other's.
I swallow down some bubbles.
I'm starving, I say. I'm ordering.
Bella lets me. I get a Greek salad, lamb souvlaki, spanakopita, and roasted eggplant with tahini. We sink into the food like a bath.
Do you remember the first time we came here? Bella asks me.
We rarely make it through a meal without her repurposing some memory. She is so sentimental. Sometimes I think about our old age and it seems intolerable to have to sift through that much history. We have 25 years now, and there's already too much to pull from, too much to make her weepy. Old age is going to be brutal.
No, I say, it's a restaurant. We've come here a lot.
Bella rolls her eyes.
You had just moved down from Columbia, and we were celebrating your job with Clarknell.
I shake my head. We celebrated Clarknell at Daddy-O, the bar off 7th we used to frequent at all hours of the night for the first 3 years we lived in the city.
No, Bella says,
We met Carl and Berg there before we came here, just you and me.
She's right, we did. I remember the tables all had candles on them, and there was a bowl of Jordan almonds by the door. I scooped two handfuls into the pouch in my purse on the way out. They don't keep them stocked anymore, probably because of customers like me.
Maybe we did, I say. Bella shakes her head. You can never be wrong.
It's actually part of my job description, I say.
But I seem to remember a night in late 2014. Way before David, Bella says.
Yeah.
You love him, she says.
It's a strange thing to ask, and it's not lost on either one of us, this question, and that she's asked it.
I do, I say. We want so many of the same things. We have the same plans. It fits, you know?
Bella cuts a slice of feta and spears a tomato on top.
So you know what it's like then, she says.
What?
To feel like you've met your person.
Bella holds my gaze, and I feel something sharp prick my stomach from the inside out. It's like she put the pin there. I'm sorry, I say. I'm sorry if I was weird with Aaron. I really do like him, and I love him if and whenever you do. Just take it slow, I say. She puts the bite into her mouth and chews.
Impossible, she says.
I know, I say, but I'm your best friend. I have to say it anyway.
Chapter 13. The swamp of July meets us with a heavy, cloying inevitability. The weather is going to get worse before it gets better. We still have to get through August. David asks me to meet him for lunch in Bryant Park one Wednesday toward the end of the month. In the summer, Bryant Park sets up cafe tables around the perimeter, and corporates in suits take their lunches outside. David's office is in the 30s and mine is in the 50s, so 42nd and 6th Avenue is our magic midway zone. We rarely meet for lunch, but when we do, it's usually Bryant Park. David is waiting with two Niçoise salads from Pret and my favorite Arnold Palmer from Le Pain Quotidien. Both establishments are in walking distance and have indoor seating so we can eat there in the colder months. We're not fancy lunch people. I'd be happy with a deli salad for two meals out of three most days. In fact, one of our first dates was to this very park with these very salads. We sat outside even though it was too cold, and when David noticed me shivering, he unwrapped his scarf and put it around me. Then he jumped up to get me a hot coffee from the cart on the corner. It was a small gesture, but so indicative of who he was, who he is. He's always been willing to put my happiness before his comfort. I take a car down to meet him, but I'm still drenched when I arrive. It's 100 degrees, I say, folding myself into the seat across from him. My heels are rubbing blisters into the backs of my feet. I need talcum powder and a pedicure immediately. I can't remember the last time I stopped to get my nails done. Actually, it's 96, but it feels like 102, David says, reading off his phone. I blink at him. Sorry, he says, but I understand the point. Why are we outside? I reach for my drink. It's miraculously still cold, even though the ice has almost melted entirely. Because we never get any fresh air. This is hardly fresh, I say. Do the summers keep getting worse?
Yes.
I'm too hot to even eat.
Good, he says, because the food was a ruse.
He drops a calendar book down on the table between us.
What is this?
It's a planner, he says. Dates, times, numbers. We need to start getting organized about this thing.
The wedding?
Yes, he says. The wedding. Unless we start making phone calls, everything's going to be booked. They are already. We're too tired at night to talk about it, and this is how we got 4 years down the line. And a half, I remind him.
Right, he says. And a half.
He bites his bottom lip and shakes his head at me. We need a human planner, I say.
Yes, but we need to plan to even get a planner. A lot of the top people book up 2 years in advance.
I know, I say, I know.
I'm not saying this is like your area, David says, but I think we should do it together. I'd like that, if you want.
Of course, I say, I'd love that. This is how badly David wants to marry me.
He'll take his lunch hour to look over brides.
No cheesy shit, he says.
I'm offended at the suggestion, I say.
And I don't think we should have a wedding party, he says. Too much work, and I don't want a bachelor party. Pat's in Arizona didn't exactly go according to plan. They booked the wrong hotel and ended up getting delayed at the airport for 9.5 hours. Everyone got drunk on beers and Bloody Marys, and David was hungover the rest of the weekend.
I'm with you. Bella can hold our rings or something.
Fine.
And white flowers only.
Works for me. Heavy cocktail hour. Who cares about dinner?
Exactly.
And open bar. But no shots.
David smiles.
No special wedding shot?
All right, then.
He flips over his wrist.
Nice progress. I gotta go.
That's it? I say, planner and run?
You wanna have lunch now?
I look at my phone. 7 missed calls and 32 new emails.
No, I was late when I got here.
David stands and hands me my salad.
I take it.
We'll get it done, I tell him.
I know we will.
I imagine David wearing a sweater and a gold band on his ring finger, opening wine in our kitchen on a cozy winter night. A sense of sustained comfort, the materials of a warm life.
I'm happy, I tell him.
I'm glad, he says, because either way, you're stuck with me.
Chapter 14. It's now the end of August. Long ago in January, David and I booked a summer share in Amagansett for Labor Day weekend with Bella and our friends Morgan and Ariel. Bella and Aaron are still together, and unsurprisingly, Aaron is joining us on this trip, turning the weekend into a triple date, which is fine by me. Historically, Bella and I are on opposite schedules at the beach. She sleeps late and parties late. I wake up at dawn and go for a run, cook us breakfast, and fit in a few hours of work before heading down to the water. David rented us a zip car, which is proving problematic in transporting us, our luggage, and Morgan, who is meant to be driving with us. Ariel is taking the jitney later after work.
This thing looks like it belongs on a Monopoly board, Morgan says. She's in her 40s, which you'd never know except for the salt and pepper hair she sports. She has a baby face, no wrinkles, not even the tiny lines around her eyes. It's wild. I've been sneaking Botox since I was 29, although David would murder me if he ever found out.
They said it fits 4.
David is shoving my weekend bag over our suitcase, jamming his shoulder into the trunk and pushing.
4 tiny people and their tiny people purses.
I laugh. We haven't even tried to fit Morgan's backpack or roller bag in yet. 2 hours later, we're on our way in an SUV David rented last minute from Hertz. We leave the zip car parked illegally on our street with the promise from a manager of imminent pickup. Morgan sits up front with David while I balance my computer on my knees in the back. It's Thursday, and although this week is sanctioned vacation, there is still work to be done. They're singing along to Lionel Richie, Endless Love. And I want to share all my love with you. No one else will do.
This reminds me, I yell forward. We need a list of do not plays for the wedding.
Morgan turns the music down.
How is planning going?
David shrugs.
Cautiously optimistic.
He's lying, I say. We're totally behind.
How did you guys do it? David asks.
Morgan and Ariel were married 3 years ago in an epic weekend in the Catskills. They rented out this themed inn called the Roxbury, and the whole wedding took place in various structures on a neighboring farm. They brought in everything, tables, chairs, chandeliers. They arranged artful bales of hay to separate the lounge area from the dance floor. There was a cheese and whiskey bar, and every table had the most gorgeous arrangement of wildflowers you'd ever seen. Photos from their wedding were on the cut and Vogue online.
It was easy, Morgan says.
We're not on their level, babe, I say. Our entire apartment is white. Morgan laughs.
Please, you know it's what I love to do. We had fun with it.
She fiddles with the dial on the radio.
So, Greg is coming?
I think so, is he?
David looks back at me.
Yep.
He seems great, right? Morgan asks.
Really nice, David says. We've only met him, what, once? It's been a crazy summer. I can't believe it's over.
He glances at me in the rear view.
Almost over, Morgan says.
I make a non-committal noise in the back seat.
He seems stable, though, like he has a real job and isn't constantly trying to get her to leave the country on her parents' credit card, David continues.
Not like us zany freeloader artists, Morgan teases.
Hey, David says, you're more successful than any of us.
It's true. Morgan sells out every show she puts on. Her photos go for $50,000. She gets more for a 24-hour editorial job than I make in 2 months.
We had a great time with him at dinner a few weeks ago, Morgan says. She seems different. I went by the gallery last week, too, and thought so again. Like more grounded or something.
I agree, I volunteer, she does.
The truth is that since that day in the park, since David and I started talking about the wedding seriously, I've thought about my vision less and less. We're building the right future now, the one that we've been working toward. All evidence is on our side that that version will be the one we're living come December. I'm not worried.
Her longest relationship by a mile already, Morgan says.
You think this one will stick?
I hit save on an email draft.
Seems that way.
We turn off the main highway, and I close my computer. We're nearly there. The house is the one we've rented for this same week the last 5 summers in a row. It's in Amagansett, down Beach Road. It's old. The shingles are falling off and the furniture is mildewy, and yet it's perfect because it's right on the water. There's nothing separating us from the ocean but a sand dune. I love it. As soon as we pass the Stargazer and turn onto 27, I lower the window to let in the thick, salty air. I immediately start to relax. I love the massive old trees lining the lanes and stretching down to that wide expanse of beach. Big sky, big ocean, and air. Room. When we pull up to the house, it's already late in the afternoon, and Bella and Aaron are there. She rented a yellow convertible, and it's parked out front, a chipper greeting. The door to the house is flung open, as if they've just arrived, although I know they haven't. Bella texted me they were there hours ago. My first instinct is to be annoyed. How many summers, how many times have I told her to keep the doors closed so we don't get bugs? But I check myself. This is our house, after all, not just mine. And I want all of us to have a nice weekend. I help David unload the trunk, handing Morgan her roller as Bella comes out of the house. She has on a pale blue linen dress, the bottom of which has paint splotches on it. This fills me with a very particular kind of joy. To my knowledge, she hasn't painted all year, and the sight of her, hair wild in the wind, the atmosphere of creation hanging around her like mist, is wonderful to witness.
You made it!
She throws her arms around Morgan and gives me a big kiss on the side of my head.
I told Ariel we'd pick her up at the East Station in, like, 20 minutes. David, can you grab her? I can't figure out how to put the top up.
She gestures toward the perky convertible.
I can do it, Morgan says.
It's no problem. This from David, even though traffic was horrific and we'd been in the car for nearly 5 hours. Let me just drop our stuff.
Bella kisses me on both cheeks.
Come on in, she says to Morgan. I did room assignments.
David raises his eyebrows at me as we follow the two of them inside. The house is decorated in part like an old farmhouse, and in part like a college girl's first shabby chic apartment. Old wooden boxes and furniture intermix with white oversized couches and Laura Ashley pillows.
You two are downstairs again,
Bella says to David and me. The downstairs bedroom is ours, and has been since we first rented the house the summer Francesco came, and he and Bella fought loudly in the kitchen for 36 hours before he pulled away in the middle of the night with the one and only car we'd rented for the weekend.
Morgan and Ariel are upstairs with us.
You know we don't swing straight, Morgan says, already on the stairs.
I'm not straight, Bella says.
Yeah, but your boyfriend is.
David and I set our suitcases down in the bedroom. I sit on the bed, which is wicker, as is the dresser and the rocking chair, and I'm hit with a nostalgia I don't usually experience or entertain.
They got new sheets this year, David says.
I look down and he's right. They're white when they're usually some mix of paisley. David leans down and brushes his lips to my forehead.
I'm gonna jet. You need anything?
I shake my head. I'll unpack for us. He stretches, bending over and grabbing onto opposite elbows with his hands. I stand up and rub the spot on his lower back that I know pinches. He winces.
Do you want me to drive? I ask. I can go. You just drove for 5 hours.
No, David says, still folded in half. I forgot to put you on the rental agreement. He lifts himself and I hear his vertebrae crack on the way up.
Bye.
He kisses me and leaves, grabbing the keys out of his pocket.
I open the closet to find a hanging rod, but no hangers. As usual, Bella has stolen them all and taken them upstairs.
I plod into the hallway in search of the coat closet and find Aaron in the kitchen.
Hey, he says. You guys made it.
Sorry, I went for a swim. He's dressed in board shorts with a towel draped over his shoulders like a cape. David went to town to get Ariel, I say. Aaron nods.
That was really nice of him. I would have been happy to go.
David loves the car. It's no problem, I say. He smiles. Morgan is upstairs with Bella. I point toward the ceiling with my index finger. I hear their feet moving on the floorboards above us.
You hungry?
He asks me. He goes to the refrigerator and takes out 3 avocados. I'm struck by his ease, his belonging here.
Right, you cook, I say.
He cocks his head at me.
I just mean, Bella said.
He nods in response. What Bella actually said was that he made butternut squash and sage risotto, but before she could have one little bite, they'd had sex on the counter right there in the kitchen. I blink away the image and run my hands down my face, shaking my head.
So is that a no on guacamole?
What? No, yes, definitely. I'm starving, I say.
You have interesting ways, Miss Cohan.
He starts piling ingredients onto the counter. Onions, cilantro, jalapenos, and a variety of vegetables.
Can I help? I ask. You can open that tequila, he says.
He gestures with his head to the countertop, where our booze for the weekend is artfully displayed. I find the tequila.
Ice? I ask. I'll pour.
Thanks. I take 2 small tumbler glasses down from the cabinet and pour a finger of tequila in each one. I pull out the ice tray, careful to hold the bottom drawer of the freezer when I do, another quirk of the house.
Heads up!
Aaron tosses me a lime. I miss, and it rolls out of the room. I'm chasing it on my hands and knees when Bella comes floating down the stairs, still in her blue tunic, hair now up.
Rogue lime, I say, snatching it before it scurries under the sofa.
I'm starving, she says. What do we have?
Aaron is making guacamole.
Who?
I shake my head.
Greg, sorry.
What do you guys want to do for dinner? Bella asks us. I follow her into the kitchen, and she snakes her arms around Aaron's waist, kissing him on the back of the neck. He offers her up his tequila. She shakes her head. I know, of course, that they've gotten closer. That while I've been at work all summer, Bella has been falling for this man. That they've been to museums and outdoor concerts and cool, tiny wine bars. They've walked the West Side Highway at dusk and the High Line at sunrise and had sex on every single piece of furniture in her brownstone. Almost. She's told me all of it.
But seeing them now, I'm met with a prick in my chest that I'm not entirely sure how to identify.
I take a seat at the counter and pick a tortilla chip out of the bag that Aaron has set out. He scoops some diced onions onto the back of a knife and dusts them into the guacamole bowl.
Where did you learn to cook? I ask.
Anyone with knife skills impresses me. I like to believe it's the one thing that prevents me from being a good cook.
I'm kind of self-taught, he says.
He nudges Bella to the side and opens the oven. In goes an array of sliced peppers, onions, and potatoes.
But I grew up around food. My mom was a cook.
I know what that means. It's not the words themselves, although they are markers, but the way he says it, with a slight bewildered edge, like he can't quite believe it either. I'm sorry, I say.
He looks back at me. Thank you. It was a long time ago.
Dinner? Bella asks.
Her hands are on her hips, and Aaron loops his arms through hers, pulling her in and kissing her on the side of her face.
Whatever you want, he says. I've got snacks covered.
Tonight we have reservations at the grill, or we can walk to Hampton Chutney if we're not in the mood for something serious, I say.
I'm always in charge of dinner reservations. Bella is always in charge of choosing which ones we use.
I thought the grill was tomorrow night.
I grab my phone and pull up our reservations document.
Huh, you're right, I say. It is tomorrow night.
Good, Bella says. I wanted to stay in anyway.
She snuggles closer to Aaron, who loops an arm around her.
We can call David and ask him to stop at the store.
No need, Aaron says. We came loaded. I have plenty to cook. He goes to the fridge and yanks it open. I peer over the counter. I see rainbows of vegetables and fruits, paper-wrapped cheeses, fresh parsley and mint, containers of oily olives, some rolling lemons and limes, and a large wedge of Parmesan. We are supremely stocked.
You got all of this? I ask.
In prior years, I'd be lucky to show up to a stick of butter. There is never anything in Bella's fridge but mossy lemons and vodka.
What do you think? She asks me.
That I can't believe you went grocery shopping. She beams. I head out onto the back patio, which overlooks the ocean. It's cloudy today, and I shiver a little in my t-shirt and shorts. I need to grab a sweatshirt. I breathe in the fresh air, salty and tangy, and I exhale out the drive, the week, Aaron in the kitchen. I open my eyes to the slow, melodic stylings of Frank Sinatra. All the Way wafts outside. I'm instantly reminded of the Rainbow Room, of twirling slowly under that rotating ceiling. I turn around. Through the window, I can see Aaron, his arms around Bella, moving her to the beat. Her head is on his shoulder, and there's a slight smile on her face. I wish I could take a picture. I've known her for 25 years, and I've never seen her this relaxed with anyone. This herself. And I've never seen her close her eyes against a man. I wait to go back inside until I hear the crunch of David's car returning on the gravel. By that time, the sun has already almost entirely set. There is just the fading of light, a slight blue on the disappearing horizon.
Chapter 15. When Bella and I were in high school, we used to play a game we called Stop. We'd see how far we could get in describing the grossest, nastiest thing before the other would be so revolted they'd have to yell out Stop. It started with an unfortunate piece of forgotten freezer meat and carried on from there. There were anthills, poison ivy welts, the intestines of a cow, and the microenvironment at the bottom of the community swimming pool. This game comes to mind the next morning when I come upon a dead seagull on my run. Its head is bent at an impossible angle, and its wings are shredded, the meaty portion, or what's left of it, being feasted on by flies. A piece of its red spine sits disconnected from its body. I remember reading once that when a seagull dies, it falls out of the sky on the spot. You could just be sitting on the beach, enjoying an orange ice pop, and wham, seagull to the head. The fog is thick, a hazy mist that hangs over sand like a blanket. If I could see for a mile, which I can't, I might spot a fellow morning jogger out for training for the fall marathon. But as far as my eye can see, it's just me here now. I bend down closer to the seagull. I don't think it's been dead a long time, but here, out in nature, things evolve quickly. I snap a picture to show Bella. No one was awake when I got up. David was like a log next to me, and the upstairs was still, but then it was barely six. Sometimes Ariel gets up to do work. I tried last summer to get her to jog with me, but there were so many excuses, and it took so long that this year I vowed to invite no one. I've never been a late sleeper, but these days anything past seven feels like noon. I need the morning. There's something about being the first one awake that feels precious, rare. I feel accomplished before I've even had my first cup of coffee.
The whole day is better. The return is short, no more than 2 miles, and when I get back, the house is still asleep. I take the gray shingled stairs to the kitchen and edge the sliding door open. My shirt is damp from my run, a combination of sweat and sea mist. I take it off, toss it over the back of a chair, and head toward the coffee pot just in my sports bra. Lit up, filter in, 4 giant scoops and an extra for the pot. It's a full house. I'm leaning forward, elbows on the counter, waiting for the first drips of caffeine when I hear Bella's feet on the stairs. I can always tell it's her. I know the way her body sounds. I can hear the way she walks, honed from decades of sleepovers, her cushioned feet padding around the kitchen for late-night snacks. If I were blind, I think I'd be able to tell every time she entered a room. "You're up early," I say.
"I didn't drink last night."
I hear her slide onto a stool, and I take a second mug down from the cabinet.
"Did you sleep well?"
David is a silent sleeper. No snoring, no movement. Being in bed with him is like being alone. "I love waking up to the ocean," I say.
"It reminds me of when your parents had that place at the shore, remember?"
The coffee starts to descend in a sputtering fit. I turn toward Bella. Her hair is down and tangled around her, and she's wearing a white lace nightgown with a long terry cloth bathrobe opened over it.
"You came there?" I ask.
She looks at me like I'm crazy.
"Yeah, you guys had it until we were like 14.
I shake my head.
"We got rid of it after Michael,"
I say. Still, all these years later, I can't bring myself to use the word.
"No, you didn't," she says. "You kept it for like 4 more summers. The place in Margate, the one with the blue awning?"
I take the pot out. It hisses in anger. It's not time. And I pour her half a cup, sitting it down on the counter in front of her.
"That wasn't ours." "No, it was," Bella says. "It was on the ocean block, that little white house with the blue awning. The blue awning!"
"There was no awning," I say. I go to the refrigerator and take out almond milk and hazelnut coffee mate. Bella remembered and picked it up for me.
"Yes, there was," she says. "It was 2 blocks from the Wawa. And you guys kept bikes down there, and we'd lock them up at the condos with the blue awnings."
I hand her the almond milk. She shakes and pours. "There was a dead seagull on the beach today," I say.
"Gross. Rotting carcass, snapped spine into bone-popping shreds, fly-eaten eyes pecked down to hollow sockets."
"Stop." I slide her my phone and she looks.
I've seen worse.
"You know they fall out of the sky when they die," I say.
"Yeah, what else would you expect them to do?"
The coffee machine downshifts into maintenance, and I pour myself a full cup, adding a hefty portion of creamer. I go to sit next to Bella at the counter.
"Doesn't look like a beach day," she says. She swivels in her stool and looks outside.
"It'll burn off." She shrugs, takes a sip, makes a face. "I don't know how you drink that almond water," I say. "Why suffer? Do you know how good this is?" I hold my cup out to her.
"It's milk," she says.
"It's really not."
"It's me," she says. "I've just been feeling funky all week."
"Are you sick?"
She swallows.
I feel something catch in my throat.
"I'm pregnant," she says. "I mean, I'm pretty sure."
I look at her. Her whole face is shining. It's like staring at the sun.
"You think or you know?"
"Think," she says.
"No."
"Bella."
"I know, it's crazy. I started feeling strange last week, though."
"Have you taken a test?" She shakes her head. Bella was pregnant once before. A guy named Marcus, whom she loved as much as he loved cocaine. She never told him. We were 22, maybe 23. Our first stumbling, dazzling year in New York.
"I missed my period," she says. "I sort of thought maybe I'd get it, but I haven't. My stomach feels weird, my boobs feel weird. I've been putting it off, but I think..."
She trails off.
"Did you tell Aaron?"
She shakes her head.
"I wasn't sure there'd be anything to tell."
"How long ago was your missed period?" She takes another sip. She looks at me.
11 days ago.
We go to the store as we are. She in the nightgown with a sweatshirt thrown over, me in my running clothes. There is no one at the small town drugstore but the woman who works there, and she smiles when we hand over the test. It always surprises me that we're old enough to receive smiles now, have these moments be blessings, not curses. When we get back, the house is still quiet, asleep. We crouch in the downstairs bathroom, just the two of us, sitting nervously on the edge of the tub, stealing glances at the counter. The timer dings.
You look, she says. You tell me, I can't do it.
Two pink lines.
It's positive, I say.
Her face falls into a sea of relief so powerful I have no choice. My eyes fill with tears.
Bella, I say, stunned.
A baby, she mouths.
We close the space between us and she's in my arms. My Bella. She smells like talcum powder and lavender, and all things dewy and precious and young. I feel so protective over these two beating hearts in my arms that I can barely breathe. We pull apart, misty-eyed and incredulous and laughing.
Do you think he'll be mad? She asks me suddenly.
All at once, she's in the driver's seat of her silver Range Rover and we're listening to Anna Begins with the windows down. It's summer and it's late. We were supposed to be home hours ago, but no one is at Bella's house. Her mother is in New York for the opening of a restaurant, and her father is traveling for work. We're coming from Josh's house, or is it Trey's? They both have pools. We're still wearing our bathing suits, but they're dry now. The air is hot and sticky, and I have this sense in me, born of youth and vodka and the Counting Crows, that we are invincible. I look over at Bella, sitting back at the wheel, mouth open, singing. And I think that I never want to be without her. And then that I never want to share her. That she belongs to me. That we belong to each other. I don't know, I say, but it doesn't matter. This is our baby. She giggles.
I love him, she says. I know it sounds crazy. I know you think I'm crazy, but I really, really do.
She puts a hand on her belly right on top of her nightgown. I don't think you're crazy, I say. I trust you. That's a first, she says. Her hand is still resting there on her belly. I see it growing, floating out in front of her like an inflatable balloon. Well, I say, then it's about time. Chapter 16. Bella says she doesn't want to tell anyone. Not this weekend. Not until she's back in the city with Aaron. Let's just enjoy the beach, she says. And we do. We bring coolers, chairs, and blankets to the beach and stay there swimming and eating salty chips and dripping watermelon, drinking beers and lemonade until the sun slips into the horizon. Ariel and Morgan go for a walk in between swim sessions. I see them down the beach, clad in matching board shorts, holding hands. David and Aaron toss a frisbee for a little while. Bella and I lounge under an umbrella. It's idyllic, and I have a flash of years forward, all of us here together, and her baby toddling by the shore. Want to go for a walk? I ask David when he comes back. He plops down on the blanket next to me. His shirt is wet at the chest, and his sunglasses hang down by his nose. I take them off and see that the skin around his eyes is sunburned, rimmed. We love it out here, but neither of us was made for the sun. I was hoping for a nap, he says. He kisses my cheek. His face is sweaty, and I feel the moisture on my skin. I hand him the sunblock. I'll go. I look up to see Aaron dripping over me, a beach towel flung over his right shoulder. Oh! I look to my side to where Bella is fast asleep on a beach blanket, her mouth slightly ajar. Her foot dangling softly in the sand like a limp puppet. I look to David. Problem solved, he says. Okay, I say to Aaron. I stand up and brush myself off. I'm wearing board shorts, a bikini top, and a wide-brimmed hat I got at a resort in Turks and Caicos on a trip with David's family 3 years ago. I tighten the strings. East or west, he asks me. I actually think it's north or south. He's not wearing sunglasses and he squints at me, his face scrunching against the sun. Left, I say. The Amagansett beach is wide and long, one of the many reasons I love it so much. You can walk for miles uninterrupted, and many stretches are nearly deserted, even in the summer months. We start walking. Aaron loops his towel around his neck and pulls with each hand at the edges. Neither one of us speaks for a minute. I'm struck, not by the silence, but by the crash of the ocean. The sense of peace I feel in nature, I feel here. I don't think I realize, living in New York, how much light and noise pollution affect my day-to-day life. I tell him this now. It's true, he says. I really miss Colorado. Is that where you're from? He shakes his head. It's where I lived after college. I just moved to New York like 10 months ago. Really? He laughs. Am I that jaded already? I shake my head. No, I'm just surprised whenever someone has spent a good portion of their adult life somewhere else. Weird, I know. Not weird, he says. I get it. New York kind of makes you feel like it's the only place in existence. I kick up a shell. That's because it is, says its insanely biased inhabitants. Aaron threads his fingers together and stretches upward. I keep my eyes on the sand. David's great, he says. It's been nice to spend some time with him this weekend. I look down at my left hand. The ring catches the summer light in sudden, brilliant bursts. I should have taken it off today. I could lose it in the water. Yeah, I say, he's great. I'm jealous of your relationship with Bella. I don't have that many friends from high school I'm still that close with. We've been friends since we were 7 years old, I say. I barely have a childhood memory she's not a part of. You're protective of her, he says. It's not a question. Yes, she's my family. I'm glad someone is looking out for her. You know, besides me. He tries for a smile. I know you are, I say. It wasn't you. She's just dated people who didn't really put her first. She falls in love quickly. I don't, he says. He clears his throat. The moment stretches out to the horizon. I mean, I haven't in the past. I know what he's saying. What he's hesitant to say now, even to me. He's in love with her, my best friend. I look over at him, and his eyes are fixed out on the ocean. Do you surf? He asks me. Really? He turns back to me. He wears a sheepish expression. I thought I might be embarrassing you with this bleeding heart. You weren't, I say. I think I brought it up. I walk a few paces down to the water's edge. Aaron joins me. No, I say, I don't surf. There are no surfers out there right now, but it's late. The real ones are usually gone by 9 a.m. Do you? No, but I always wanted to. I didn't grow up around the ocean. I was 16 before I went to the beach for the first time. Really? Where are you from? Wisconsin, he says. My parents weren't big travelers, but when we went on vacation, it was always to the lake. We rented this house on Lake Michigan every summer. We'd stay there for a week and just live on the water. Sounds nice, I say. I'm trying to convince Bella to go with me in the fall. It's still one of my favorite places. She's not much of a lake girl, I say. I think she'd like it. He clears his throat. Hey, he says, thanks for earlier. I don't really ever talk about my mom. I look down at my feet. It's okay, I say. I get it. The water comes up to greet us. Aaron jumps back. Shit, that's cold, he says. It's not that bad. It's August. You don't even want to know what it feels like in May. He hops around for another moment and then stops, staring at me. All at once, he kicks up the retreating water. It lands on me in a cascade, the icy droplets dotting my body like chicken pox. Not cool, I say. I splash him back, and he holds up his towel in defense. But then we're running farther into the ocean, gathering more and more water in our attacks, until we're both soaking wet, his towel nothing more than a dripping deadweight. I duck my head under the water and let the shock of cold cool my head. I don't bother taking off my hat. When I come back up, Aaron is a foot from me. He stares at me so intently I have the instinct to look behind me, but don't. What? Nothing, he says. I just... He shrugs. I like you. Instantly, I'm not in the Atlantic anymore. We're not here on this beach, but instead in that apartment, in that bed. His hands, devoid of the sopping towel, are on me. His mouth on my neck, his body moving slowly, deliberately over mine, asking, needing, pressing. The pulse of the blood in my veins pumping to a rhythm of yes. I close my eyes. Stop, stop, stop. Race you back, I say. I kick up some water and take off. I know I'm faster than him. I'm faster than most people, and he's weighted down by 10 pounds of towel. I'll beat him in a flash. When I get back to the blanket, Bella is awake. She rolls over, sleepily shielding her eyes from the sun. Where did you go? She asks. I'm breathing too hard to answer.
Chapter 17. September is a busy season at work. If everyone agrees to take a collective breath at the end of August, then September is a full-on sprint. I come back from the beach to a pile of documents and don't look up from them until Friday. Bella calls me on Wednesday, gasping with laughter. I told him, she says. She squeals, and I hear Aaron there next to her. I imagine his arms around her chest, careful with her, with this life now between them. And? Danny says, and? Bella says. I hear static, and then Aaron is on the line. Danny, hey. Hi, I say. Congratulations. Yeah, thanks. Are you happy? He pauses. I feel my stomach tighten. But then, when I hear him speak, it's the purest, most obvious resonance of joy. It fills up the phone. You know, he says, I really, really am. On Saturday, Bella and I pick up coffees at Le Pain Quotidien on Broadway because she wants to go shopping. I expect we'll hit up the stores on Lower Fifth, maybe pop into Anthropology, J. Crew, or Zara. But instead, I find myself, Americano in hand, standing outside of Jacotti, the French baby store on Broadway. We have to go in, she says. Everything is too adorable. I follow her. There are rows of tiny onesies with matching cotton hats, knit sweaters, tiny overalls. It's a shrunken department store, full of petite Mary Janes and patent leather loafers, all in minute, pocketable sizes. Bella is wearing a pink silk slip dress with an oversized white cotton sweater tied at the waist. Her hair is wild. She's glowing. She looks beautiful, radiant, like a goddess. It's not that I don't want kids, but I've just never felt particularly drawn to motherhood. Babies don't make me coo and weaken, and I've never experienced any sort of biological clock about my reproductive window. I think David would be a good father, and that we'll probably go ahead and have kids one day, but when I think about that future picture, us with a child, I often come up blank. When is your doctor's appointment? I ask her. Bella holds up a little yellow and white polka dot jumper. Do you think this is gender neutral? I shrug. The baby will be here in the spring, so we need some long-sleeved stuff. She hands me the jumper and pulls two off-white cable-knit sweaters from the table in different sizes. How is Aaron? I ask. She smiles dreamily. He's great. He's excited. I mean, it's sudden, of course, but he seems really happy. We're not 25 anymore. Right, I say. Are you guys going to get married? Bella rolls her eyes and hands me a pair of socks with tiny anchors on them. Don't be so obvious, she says. You're having a baby. It's a legitimate question. She turns to me, her whole body focused now. We haven't even discussed it. This seems like enough for now. So when's the doctor? I ask, switching gears. I want to see that sonogram pic. Bella smiles. Next week. They said not to rush coming in. When it's this early, there isn't much to do anyway. But shop, I say. My arms are full of small items now. I shuffle toward the register counter. I think it's a girl, Bella says. I have an image of her sitting in a rocking chair, holding an infant wrapped in a soft pink blanket. A girl would be great, I say. She pulls me in and tucks me to her side. Now you have to get started too, she says. I imagine being pregnant, shopping in this store for my own tiny creation. It makes me want a cocktail. On Sunday, I go over to her apartment,
I ring the bell twice. When the door finally opens, Aaron is there. Or at least his head is. He pulls the door back and I'm met with at least a dozen packages. Boxes and baskets and all sorts of gifts littering the entryway. Did you guys rob a department store, I ask? Aaron shrugs. She's excited, he says. So she's shopping? I watch his face closely, looking for signs of judgment or hesitation. But I find none. Only a little amusement. He's dressed in jeans and a white t-shirt, no socks. I wonder if he's moved some stuff in yet. If he will. They'll have to live together, won't they? He kicks a box to the side and the door swings open. I enter and close it behind me. Congratulations, I say. Oh, yeah, thanks. He's stacking a garment bag on top of an Amazon delivery. He stops. He stands, tucks his hands into his pockets. I know it's pretty soon. Bella has always been impatient, I say, so it doesn't totally surprise me. He laughs, but it seems more for my benefit. I just want you to know I really am happy. She's the best thing that's ever happened to me. He looks right at me when he says it, the same way he did at the beach. I blink away. Good, I say. I'm glad. Just then, Bella's voice floats in from the other room.
Danny, are you here?
Aaron smiles and steps to the side, holding his arm out for me to pass. I follow the sound of her voice down the hallway, past the kitchen and her bedroom and into the guest room. The bed has been pushed to the side, the dresser placed in the center of the room, and Bella, in overalls and a headscarf, is painting white marshmallow clouds on the walls. Bells, I say, what's going on? She looks at me.
Baby's room, she says. What do you think?
She stands back, putting her hands on her hips and surveying her work. I think you're ahead of the curve for the first time in your life, I say. And it's freaking me out. Isn't the nursery usually a month 7 project? She laughs, her back to me.
It's fun, she says. I haven't really painted in a long time.
I know. I go to stand next to her and lob an arm over her shoulder. She leans into me. The clouds are off-white and the sky is a pale salmon color with shades of baby blue and lavender. It's a masterpiece. You really want this, I say, but it's not really to her. It's to the wall, to whatever beyond has brought forth this reality. For a moment, I don't remember the future I once saw. I am overcome by the one that is solidly, undeniably present here.